We're excited to continue in sort of understanding race, religion, and resistance in America. Let me begin by saying, are there any, there was a lot to think about yesterday, so I want to give some space if there were burning things that came up yesterday in your ruminations on a walk or in the dining hall that you want to lift up before we move into today's conversation. Yeah.
One thought that kept occurring to me in the course of the discussion yesterday was that groups of people going out were acting with Christianity, the force of Christianity behind them. God was speaking through them to others, and they felt as though, I'm not even quite sure what phrase to use here, but that they were justifiably in the right, and that they were doing God's service. Mm-hmm. How do you resolve, accept, deal with that as a construct?
Yes.
Does my question make sense?
It does, it does. There is, and this is a problem with every faith tradition, right? I often use the example that, let me say it this way. That is our family conversation as Christians, right? We have to wrestle with the fact that good, well-meaning, although they weren't good or well-meaning, but there are good, well-meaning Christians who seek to do certain things in the name of Christ that a whole other group of Christians will say, that's not what we represent, right? That a whole, you see of that, y'all come on in. The most cute example of that we can lift up is from another tradition where Muslims had to wrestle with the fact that there were people in those planes on 9/11 who were doing something from their position, right? And then what do we have to do? We had to allow good faithful Muslims to say, that's not us, right? And in the same way, we as Christians have never dealt with the fact that we have to say, you know what? That might not be, the forced baptisms may not be, all right, you know, maybe that's not us, right? So, we've never had that conversation, certainly at our local church levels. We've never talked about that, or not to the degree that certainly we talked about it yesterday. So, how do we reconcile that? We begin by having hard conversations and saying, you know, that's not actually the faith. And here's the other struggle of that. If any of those folks from the 16th and 17th century come and see our brand of Christianity now, they're going to say the exact same, that's not, right?
That dialogue continues to this day.
Exactly. We're doing it right now, right? There are a whole group of progressive Christians who are looking at evangelical Christians saying, that's not Jesus, right? And we're pointing to each other back and forth. And I think the real struggle of our faith, when I teach students, is to say, both extremes are probably wrong. And the truth of the matter is, there's a whole healthy lot of conviction in front of Jesus' words for all of us, right? So there are a lot of ways in which evangelical Christians do, in fact, get personal piety right. Right? There are a lot of ways to get it wrong. There are a lot of ways to get it right. And there are a lot of ways in which the progressive arm of the church that says, you know, this is a social faith, they get it right, but they also get it wrong in a lot of ways. And the problem is, we live in a world of extremes. I shared with somebody the other day that I abhor binaries. Do not give me this or that, because I'm always going to look for a third path, a third way. And it's not always to integrate the polls, right? Maybe we just do something different all the time. But good question, very good question.
Back in the 16th and 17th century, were there any faith traditions that were abolitionist and pro-black, like Quakers?
Yes. So the best example would be Quakers. The best example would be Quakers who fully recognized the personhood of everybody. But they also were pacifists. And they also were a lot of countercultural things that, you know, the larger dominant society said, they just ignore them, right? That's why the greatest legacy of Quakers are love. Oaths. I'm not trying to be, you know, derisive, but I'm just saying, in the popular mindset,
they were radical.
Yeah, they were radical for their time, and they were ignored in their time. Right? even though they founded a whole colony.
Didn't we learn yesterday about the participation in the schools for Native American youth? I mean, Quakers aren't.
Yeah.
They're not innocent, right? They're not totally innocent, right? Part of where this idea of silence is complicity, that is not a new idea, right? And so that is part of the legacy of what we're going to be talking about today, is just because you or your group did not participate, this system is so hegemonic, it is so all-inclusive, that non-resistance is compliance. And that's one of the hard lessons you have to recognize, is just because you, your family, or your lineage, or your country, or your whatever, did not do, if you are not actively resisting it, then it's so all-inclusive that you still were contributing to it. And that's hard, that's personal work, where you have to really say, not me, not me, not me. And that's why I said, if you're not doing the intentional work of examining and unpacking, then every local congregation is an outpost of Christendom, if you're not actively resisting that part of yourself. Today's content really is about understanding the catchphrase that we've been throwing around a long time, particularly in diversity, equity, and inclusion work, which is white privilege, right? When I've done IDIs and DEI work, we throw that term around, white privilege, and I hear a lot of white people say, you know, I'm inherited white privilege, and I usually go back and say, what does that mean? What does that mean to you? Well, you know, I'm inheriting of a system that such and such. Yeah, but how is that particularly yours to bear, right? And most of us don't know that. So what this is about is actually unpacking what privilege means, so that I know you may have grown up in the mountains of West Virginia and your family such and such and so forth, and you scraped and scrambled and you were poor, or you grew up on welfare and all that. All of those things are real, and I'm not taking away any of those realities. But you can be all of those things and still inherit privilege. And so we're going to talk about how that's possible. Okay? So that when you actually say to people, I'm an inheritor of white privilege, you actually know what that means. And you can say, I'm an inheritor of white privilege in these ways. Does that make sense? You ready for the journey?
Ready.
All right. Now, you are going to be upset. Do not be upset with me. The place for you to be upset is with your historical forebears, the individuals who constructed this system. And I will also say, persons of color, black, indigenous persons of color in this country in particular, because that's where we're going to focus our energy, have already navigated these things, because in order to navigate America, you must navigate these things. But these are realities that you may or may not be aware of acutely. But these are daily realities for folks, right? This is why one of the things you may hear is, don't do the work yourself, don't ask black, indigenous people to do their work, do the work for you, because we already done it. We did it when we were 5 or 7, or when, I'll get into that a minute. So, there are some images that are pretty jarring in this, and they are racist images, but I'm going to show them to you because they are part of our legacy as Americans, and so we'll do that. The first image actually is coming right up, which is just jarring about the complicity, and the image says everything it needs to say. So this is an Evangelical United Brethren sanctuary. I won't tell you where it is. But the image says 1,000 words. Jesus saves at the top. And then all of that evil represented below. And the thing you have to remember is this picture was taken, well, you would know this, but this picture is taken in the 30s. So there are individuals in this picture who could be still alive to this day. Or, which is more likely, there are individuals in this picture who have had children who are absolutely alive. Racism is not a past reality. It is a passed down present. Some would even say, and this is jarring language, some would say a gift from the past generation. Wonderful quote from James Baldwin. No one was white before they came to America. He's satirizing and problematizing whiteness as a part of the American mainstream. Okay, so what is race? Race, first and foremost, is a social construct. In many respects, it is only a social construct. There are no scientific or biological rationales for the difference between whiteness or blackness as realities. There are brown people. There's a chemical reason for that, right? Brown people or darker hued people have more of a melatonin in their bodies. And some have less. That's a scientific explanation. But there's no such thing as white or black people. Does that make sense? You understand the difference? Right? You have darker hued people. Right? And you have the full spectrum of people in that way of colors. But race is a social imaginary category. It is fictional. It is made up. Right? Which makes you wonder, why in the world do we have to check boxes when we fill out government forms for stuff that really doesn't exist? Oh, well, that's because we need to count how many such and such and so forth people are participating. Well, why? Right? Especially when I go to certain things and I check white. Right? And then they look at me and say, you checked white. Yeah. Well, you... And then they get ready to ask the question. They realize how absurd it sounds. And they just say, okay. But it's an imaginary category. We made it up. It's not real. Why? Why would we make it up? Great text. Came out last year. Her other text is in the library right now. The Warmth of Other Suns is a wonderful text to read. But last year she published Caste, The Origin of Discontent, Isabel Wilkerson. Big book, quick read though. And what she talks about is every society, every human society organizes itself by castes. Different kinds, sometimes they're tribal, sometimes they're religiously constructed, sometimes they are lineage, matrilineally constructed. And castes are just ways of organizing society. Sometimes there are multiple factors involved in caste. What Wilkerson argues is that caste in American society, the acute caste in American society, is race. Right? In Europe, it may have been your birth lineage or your feudal heritage. In Africa, it may have been your proximity to the dominant tribes or the grouping. But in America, we decided to organize our society based upon race, with two distinct castes at first, white, black. Yeah?
You put gender in that?
Wilkerson does not put gender. Okay. Well, you're talking in general in terms of caste?
Yeah.
Yes, so in general, you know, your role in gender, but it's usually a subcaste. So if you a Brahmin, which is the highest caste in Indian caste system, a Brahmin woman is still higher than a Vaishya male, okay. Right? So caste is one factor, but your gender becomes a qualifying figure of caste. Yeah. But in American society, her argument is we organize by race. We're structured by race. And the higher the caste, the greater the access, the privilege. And of course, who designs the caste? Whoever's on top, right? So the people who design the caste go on top. And so it's a social construct with a theological justification. So this goes back to what we talked about yesterday, Jennings's diseased social imagination. these theological imagination as well, which then uses the social construction of race, white, black, and then uses religion to support the justification. So one of the common 19th century reasons for race distinctions, particularly white-black race distinctions, was articulated by a Presbyterian minister who used the curse of Ham from the biblical record. You recall the curse of Ham, where Ham and his descendants are marked with something that will always identify them as slaves or worthy, the biblical text. And this is where we have to, somebody said yesterday about interrogating biblical text and really wrestling with that. The text says that the mark of Ham is the sign of his curse that then will tell people that you are, that he's a slave perpetually. Okay, let's take that for a minute. We're not told what the curse, the sign of the curse is. And we're not told, certainly, that blackness or dark hue is the sign, right? But those early explorers, conquerors, when they encountered African bodies, said, this is the curse of Ham. And these are Ham's descendants, which means that we have biblical justification to enslave them. That idea becomes the dominant idea in American society that says they're not, and there's another leap that happens there. They're not just worthy of slavery, they also are not full human beings, these black bodies. So something happens when you start removing the humanity of another person. You then can do whatever you want to them. The greatest lesson of that sort of human dignity happens in the Holocaust, when you begin to talk about people as its aliens, beasts, right? You begin to remove their humanity and make them objects that are then allowed to be manipulated in whatever way we want. And so that's not a new oppressive playbook. It starts in the colonial period, right? These are savages, right? Savages aren't human beings, right? They are objects, they are beasts. If you read the language of journals, the language that is used is not, they're not humans. Especially the children. In this day and age, in the 19th century in America, they were ninnies. African-American children were called ninnies. And you would pick a ninny. Pick a ninny meant go and buy a black child. We get picnic from pick a ninny. I go to cookouts. I don't go to picnics. Right? You never knew that. There was a way of shortening it, particularly in the South, that it was the picnic was a celebration or a gathering that took place after you bought new. Oh. Have cookouts, not picnics. So this theological construct of race is rooted in Christendom. And is designed, here's the key piece, to reinforce the upper end of the caste as theologically justified, or in other words, God-sanctioned. God gave the white man to the world to order it. The white man, which means the white woman has to be ordered by the white man. And then every other quote-unquote subject falls under that same hierarchy, right? To lesser and lesser degrees. Here's the problem, or I'm staking a claim that we'll pick this thread back up tomorrow when we talk about resistance. All humanity and all human life is an embodied reality. We go through life not as spirits, but as bodies encountering realities. My reality encounters yours. Which means that living together is an embodied reality for one another. Now, this is getting really, really philosophical, so if you get confused, stay with me. What that means is, when we talk about these systems and structures, they are not theoretical. They are embodied realities. But if you are at the top of the caste, the theories don't bother you. They don't impact you. They are cognitive realities, right? And why do I say that? I say that because your cognitive understanding means nothing if you do not understand the embodied reality, right? So for a lot of folks, you don't understand the reality of African-American men or women who are deathly afraid of police, right? That's not your reality, right? You know, I'm a middle-aged man and I am still to this day deathly afraid of police because I've been profiled, right? Now, for a lot of persons who identify as white, you say things like, and you mean this, and I'm not trying to say that this is, you're speaking from a place of innocence. I'm not trying to say you're being malicious when you say this. You say, I just never knew. I didn't understand and I don't know. Well, your understanding doesn't change the fact that it's a reality. Whether you understand it or not, it's a real thing. That's what I mean by embodiment. The theories and the things that we're talking about are embodied realities that impact people's lives. What you have not ever had to deal with is the stuff that has impacted your own life that you didn't build, but you inherited. Does it make sense? Y'all walking with me? Yes.
Have you explored, or other scholars have explored how trauma is passed down?
Yes. And you know, maybe I can pull it up if I can dig through my other files. But there is a psychotherapist, a black woman, who has intimately done the work of talking about psychic trauma, embodied psychic trauma. And so we see that in the medical profession with high rates of blood pressure, high cholesterol, stress-related diseases that happen in Native American populations, that happen in African American populations. Wilkerson says, the lower you go in a caste, the higher the rates are of stress-related illnesses. And so these are all embodied realities that you don't even know you're experiencing, right? You don't experience it at the same level, the same rate as others. Yes?
I'm sorry I don't remember the author, but the book My Grandmother's Hands is mm-hmm. a wonderful exploration of that. Also,
Post-Traumatic
Slave Syndrome by Dr. Joy.
That's it. Joy. Sounds right. Post-traumatic slave syndrome is the name of the book by Joy something. We both can't remember it, but
the guy,
something like that. I'll make sure we have it. Again, Friday I'll give you a reading list, so I'll try to make sure I have it. Yes.
One thing when I read casts that really struck me and might strike a lot of people here who are Nordic heritage is that that was at the very top of the caste system.
Yeah, I said that to somebody yesterday, that you know, Norwegian, Finnish, and Nordic cultures, while they were not colonial powers in the same way, they were believed to be the whitest of white. That was the best, right? And so a lot of folks have said, Nordic folks have said, we didn't do anything. What are you talking about? Right? But there's a chart that the eugenicists during 1930s Germany, Nordic, right at the top, right? And they couldn't even define Aryan that way because Aryans, as they were trying to make Aryans into something that way. Looks like
they
that.
Also are considered the happiest countries in the world.
Presently.
Presently.
Yeah. Yes. We're above it all, literally. We're on the Arctic Circle. Yay. So the social structures, social and theological structures, embody and are designed to be legal, familial, and religious, right? So we start with the society building structures in the legal system. We'll get into each of these a little bit. And then through either schooling or other ways of just passing down heritage, we don't associate with those people. We don't go to the other side of town. Come here, son, let me tell you a story, right? These are all, that's the familial. The backbone of society are the families, right? So we build it there. And then we use religion to wrap it up in a nice neat bow, right? To justify it. So what is white, right? Have you thought about that at all? You ruminated about that? You know, you may identify as white, but you don't really know what that means. Most of us just say it's skin color, right? You know, we're white. Well, actually, no, it's not it. There are people that are whiter than folks in this room, right? So it's not a skin color issue. It's actually, again, a social imaginary construct. Kelly Brown Douglas, who I referenced yesterday, a theologian, black woman, womanist theologian, in her book, Stand Your Ground, offers some very specific definers of what it means to be white in America, right? The construct of whiteness in America. The first one sounds pretty odd, but we talked about it a bit about this yesterday, which is it's clannish in the sense that it is cliquish or an aggregation of a way of being and excluding other folks. And, oh, I lost it, sorry. So being white Anglo-Saxon Protestant is the first determiner of whiteness in the American colonies. And some of the key people, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison in particular, are arguing that that's what this country is for, right? That white Anglo-Saxon Protestant is that excludes Catholics, right? Roman Catholics aren't, this is not a Roman Catholic country, right? It takes us almost 200 years before we even elect our first Catholic president, right? So we see it, we know it, but we haven't processed it, right? There was a time in this country in which white Catholics, Irish, Italians, were not considered white. Some of you may remember the days, no Irish allowed, right? And so that tells you right there that this is not skin color, right? This is a tribal distinction, a horrible way of grabbing, of aggregating folks, right? So Eastern Europeans weren't white. What are some others? Spanish, Italians, Irish Catholics, Russians, Polish, yeah, whatnot. They weren't white at the beginning of this country, right? But what part of what Wilkerson says is over time, those ethnicities, those nationalities come to this country and they work hard to not identify as black, certainly not that, but to do what? Identify with whiteness. Right, and so one of the things that Wilkerson says is it's your proximity to that main distinctive that determines your whiteness. Right? Yes.
What causes the? Is that a determining, is religion a determining factor anymore, or is all of this still true? Because it feels like religion, or at least.
It's the oil. Religion is the oil that keeps the engine running effectively. Right? It's not the fuel anymore. At one point, it was the fuel that started the engine, but now it's just the oil. If we're to use that metaphor, right? So, if you consider the first 300 to 400 years of the colonial period being a place where we're assembling the engine, we're getting it running, we're getting it stabilized. The Enlightenment then sort of in Western civilization begins to take out the sting or the oomph of religious organization, but it's still there, right? It's still helping to keep things running. Yeah?
It's curious that so many of the explorers were from Catholic countries. But whiteness was constructed in the United States specifically, which was not Spanish. Is that why they are not original? You know, I'm just trying to understand that.
It's about who's in the room in Philadelphia in the 1770s. It's all, right? You've seen Hamilton. So you've seen Hamilton. He's like, a room where it happens, right? Who are the Catholic forefathers? Do you know any? What's the Catholic colony of the 13? Maryland. Maryland is the Catholic county, colony. It is the first, one of the first dioceses in Baltimore. It's the oldest diocese, is in Baltimore. Lord Baltimore was Catholic, right? Doesn't stay Catholic long, but it's not, by the time it signs the Constitution, it is not Catholic. And it is settled in these ways. They're not in the room. Any real numbers to make a consequence.
Is that why this construct seems to be American-oriented as opposed to European?
That's right. Right. Yeah, because there's some other things that we walk away from in the colonies. Some stuff that we're more commonly familiar with, like bloodlines, right? We walk away from European bloodlines. So you come here in the colonies, we don't care who your daddy is, right? At the beginning, it's important, but by the time we get to the independence, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, their bloodlines don't matter from connections to the old world, I mean, right? So we walk away from a lot of things in Europe. We construct our own way of casting. And one of those is based upon race. Wilkerson would argue it's the biggest. Kenneth Brown Douglas says another key piece to this to whiteness is patriarchy, right? Men rule the world, period, full stop, right? And it takes us 200-300 years for us to say, well, maybe not, and we're still fighting that battle right now to this day. But whiteness also skews towards maleness, right? So one of the things that becomes really problematic is that the way in which we have been taught that white women have not been part of the systems of oppression. It's a great text by Stephanie Jones Rogers, it'll be on the reading list, entitled, They Were Her Property, White Women and Slave Ownership. Some of the most progressive laws of land and property ownership were written in the South in the 1850s. In places like Louisiana and Mississippi, a white woman could own her own property, including the plantation and the slaves of that plantation, because their daddies wanted to make sure that their investment stayed in the family. So a white woman could get married to someone, and there were laws that protected her ownership of her property. And the only reason why was because the daddies who were sitting in the state legislatures wrote the laws so that their slaves would be still in the family, right? Now, by the time you get to the 1880s, all of those laws are repealed because slavery's gone. But she talks about just how intimately white women were involved in keeping this system alive as well. That's something that we don't hear about at all. That's why there's a distinction now between feminism and womanism, because feminism in the 1970s excluded the voices of black women and women of color in this country, right? And so part of the struggle is black women and white women, no, we're not aligned in every way, right? And that's part of the struggle of reality against how do we fight patriarchy as a collective. Whiteness has these big grand narratives, she says, right? So the United States has been created by God to have manifest destiny and to conquer sea to shining sea. And we, these big arcs that are not even really true, right? But, and then connecting it back to the old world, connecting it back to the justifying systems that are there. And then she says it's proprietary, meaning that takes territory, land and or ideas, and makes it its own. And we'll see some acute examples of that. We see that in the 20th and 21st century with American microcultures co-opting and taking over. If you were in Rachel's presentation yesterday, talking about Native American cultures being co-opted and taken for the purposes, she says that's a white phenomenon, which is attended to by colonialism. I take what I want is the basic idea here, and if you're in my way, then you do that. And then there's this idea. I'm coming to you. There's this idea of exceptionalism, which we still hear today. America is the exceptional nation, and we can do it like nobody else. That's part of the mythic, and it's part of this idea that, you know, whiteness is the best. And so then what you're trying to do is get as close to pure as possible, right? White as pure snow is not just sort of a natural metaphor. It is meant to also convey a subtext of whiteness being pure. And so the closer you are to whiteness, the purer you are. And this has a real impact on black and brown bodies and their self-understanding in this way. Yes?
My question was, are Asian Americans moving towards whiteness?
Depends on where they're from. So there's a lot of scholarship that talks about the falseness of the model minority and the ways in which Asian Americans, depending on what country they're from, have sought to identify with whiteness because of the same colonial mindset. And there's lots of research that talks about the way in which we even categorize Asian American, right? There's a continent called Asia, which means there are a lot of Asians in the world and a lot of different communities that are Asian. Indonesia, Jakarta, India, Nepalese, Korean, right? But what comes to mind in Asian American context are often, from American perspectives, are Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, right? And those are stereotypes, right? So we as Americans don't often conceive of Indian Americans as Asian, right? This is why we struggle with our vice president, right? Is she black? Is she West Indian? Is she Asian? She's all those things. So what? Right? You can be two and three things at the same time. It's fine. In fact, that may be the American way, right? But here's the problem with a black-white cast. If you're not black or white, then you got to figure out where you fit on the cast, right? So then you have folks from Central and South America who migrate to this country who, if you are white Cuban, right, light-skinned Cuban, then it's understood that you can graft yourself into whiteness. But if you are native Bolivian and you are dark-skinned, no one will ever conceive of you as, right? And we see that in the policies. So Cubans get the privilege of being feet dry, you immediately get asylum. The country that is less than 50 miles across the strait in Haiti, because of the blackness and the way in which they get their freedom, are immediately sent back. They can't even get into territorial waters and sent back, right? No questions asked, you can't be here, right? And if you are from a West African or an African country and you have dark skin, you don't conceive of this dynamic of black-white. So what are you? I'm Yoruba. No, you're black, right? So whiteness is constructed as the opposition to the lower end of the caste. Blackness is constructed first, and then what is white takes time to develop in American history and gets refined. Let me jump forward a little bit. Quickly, the theological justification for this, right? Or rather, the problematizing of the theological here. So it was understood that all humankind is made in God's image, right? It's right there in the text. But if you're able to somehow say that the image of God rests fully in a certain group of people, and another group of people aren't even people, which means they don't carry the image of God, then they become part of the other part of the command that, God gives, which is be fruitful and multiply and have dominion. So black and brown bodies become part of the dominion. Now, those are the theological constructs there. And so whiteness and godliness become symbiotic. They become hand in hand. And it's done through legal means. It's done through structures of passing down family, some of which we're getting ready to get into. And these are systems that are created and refined in the 19th and early 20th century so that by the middle of the 20th century, it becomes normative for us.
When they
left Europe. Yeah. It's propaganda. You'll see, we're going to see some images in a second, right? It's propaganda. Every society conceives of Jesus in their own way. There's a series on Starz called American Gods, and there's a scene where, you know what I'm talking about, is a scene where there's like a dinner party. So the premise of the show is that gods exist and they're real and the old gods are fighting the new gods. So you have like, I can't think of an old god.
Thor's dad.
Yeah, what is his name? I can't think of it. Thor's dad.
Odin.
So you have Odin who's running around who wants to make war on the new gods. And new gods are stuff like radio and television and stuff like that, right? So there's a scene in which the old gods are gathered at a dinner party. So it's at Easter's house. So she's a goddess. And so it's the goddess of spiritual renewal. And then, like, there are all these folks who look kind of similar. There's a bunch of the guys. They're in, like, Birkenstocks. And they look like they all came out of Holy Village. Like, they got Birkenstocks, shorts. Some of them are black. Some of them are white. Some of them are Latin American. And so Odin says to Easter, like, wow, you got a lot this year. She's like, yeah, Jesus always comes on Easter. And so they're like, well, you got a whole lot. And like there are 50 Jesuses there who are all a little bit different, by only really separated by hue. But they all have, you know, the stigmata. They all have like the mark of the throat, right? So it's, what it's saying is, it's wonderful commentary is to say, every society conceives of Jesus in their own way. Why do you think Jesus is white? Because that's all you've ever seen. Right? Why is it when I go to Africa and I sit in a colonial kind of church with a bunch of beautiful black people, there's a white Jesus on the wall? Because the church was founded by missionaries. Right? And so it really isn't until you get out of the colonial period into the 20th century that people say, you know, Jesus might not have been. Right? And the beautiful thing is Latin American liberation theologians are the first ones to actually conceive and give permission to this. Ironically, Roman Catholic folks are doing this. So it isn't that Jesus is white, we all know that, but it's not even that Jesus was only conceived of as white. It's just that was the dominant language of which we have swum in. Does that make sense? Right? So yes, Jesus is not white, but Jesus has not always been conceived of as white either. That's probably the revelation, right, there. And again, why do we conceive of Jesus that way? Because if we conceive of Jesus that way, then what does it say about us? Right. Right. So we are made in God's image. Jesus is incarnated of God, is God incarnate. So therefore, God is white. Right. Never mind of that's not what people look like where Jesus is from. So then what does that say to people who are not white? It says to us that we are not like God. We are not like God, which means we're not image bearers of God, which means then whatever the people who look like God are doing is right. And when you reinforce that with, we have the guns, we have the power, we have the control, what can we do? This is sort of the foundation of the legacy that we're built into. So here are some of the social constructs. Let's get into sort of the legal and the social here that helps us to unpack this. There's a book, it's in the dining hall actually, on the piano, if you want to see it. When we do announcements, I'll wave it behind everybody. Henry Louis Gates wrote a book entitled Stone in the Road, Reconstruction, White Supremacy, and the Rise of Jim Crow. And it details the way that white supremacy, white hegemony is furthered and sustained in America. In other words, the way that whiteness is sustained and fulfilled in the Reconstruction era. Now, why does whiteness have to be perfected in the Reconstruction era? What had just happened? Slaves have been free, and we've given them enfranchisement in a way that otherwise we did not have. And what is the concern? Say again? Loss of control.
Loss of power.
Gaining wealth.
And a fear that if you give black and brown people full autonomy and authority, they will do to us what we did to them. And here is the secret thread between that period and right now today, is giving black and brown people authority, allowing them to vote from home, means that we, in fact, they will do to us what we did to them.
You got a question.
Yeah, sorry.
Is that the reason why, like, the definition of, like, who is white or not expanded?
Say it again, definition of who?
Of who is white or not expanded to, like, Italians.
Precisely. Yes. So you get a bigger group. Okay, y'all come in too, because we need to make sure we balance our numbers. I mean, it becomes a numbers game. The bigger the group, then the bigger, right? And now what we have is not a numbers game anymore. We just have full-on attempts at apartheid, where you just change the rules in front of everybody and you make sure that you still are in power. But this thread, I'm coming to you, this thread starts in the Reconstruction era. If we allow them to vote, to cast legislation, then they will enslave us. And you'll see some of the language here that says actually that. Yes?
Was this avoidable? Was the, like, the Reconstruction white supremacy, would that have been better than anyone?
Yeah. If you didn't have a diseased social imagination that started with the... If you encountered people where they are, and perhaps we were just, as human beings, not enlightened enough. That's an excuse. Because... white European conquerors had choice, right? And you know the best example of those who embodied that choice of inhabiting someone's difference? The indigenous people they conquered. The indigenous people they conquered actually welcomed folks, processed them where they were, heard them, trusted them instinctively because they knew all the way of being, and white European conquerors actively chose to subjugate, right? And so I dismiss out of hand the argument that everybody was doing it was part of the norm. Because that very argument suggests that only white people had the agency to make those kind of changes when there were black and brown people who were constantly making those choices to accommodate, to adjust, to listen. And the white people in history didn't do it, right? Everyone throughout history had agency. Some kind of agency within their location. And so it was avoidable. It could be avoidable. I was musing last night looking at the stars saying, you know, if we ever got to another, if we ever had someone come to us from another planet, let's just hope they don't have a diseased social imagination.
Yeah.
Right? And then I said, well, maybe that is the diseased social imagination, to think that whoever comes here would act like we would. They may be more civilized than us. In this way. But there was a choice, and we our ancestors chose not to do it. So Gates establishes that the systematic creation of race theory and racism that happened in America happened because of hypocrisy. The American Republic says, you know, by the time we fight the Civil War, okay, we're against slavery, but racism still has to be in place. And part of what I want you to understand is that that's a nuance that we're not taught in American history. We think that everybody that fought against slavery was also against racism. Absolutely not. Racism was just as virulently enforced in the North as it was in the South. It just was more out in the open in the South, right? Just because you were for voting rights for black people didn't mean that you wanted them to be equal as you, right? So let me put it to you like this. Just because they could vote in a ballot box, it doesn't mean you wanted to eat with them, right? Again, the women's suffrage movement in this country did not include many black women. Nannie Helen Burroughs is a black woman, a Baptist black woman, who fought virulently for inclusion in the suffrage movement. There were ropes that separated the white women from the black women. There. Right. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and some of the others were also, I don't know if Stanton was, but some of the others of her ilk were also virulent racists in this way. You might be against racism. You know, black people are human beings. They are agents of their own being, that kind of stuff, but I don't want to shop with them. Why do they have to be here with me? Right? We see trails of this still in our society because, remember, segregation is within a generation or two of our lived existence. Right? And depending upon where you are in the country, it was right in your face and you just were taught not to look at it because it was normal. Right? Anybody grew up in the South and is here? Yeah? Yeah? And it's in the lived experience. Remember, it's an embodied reality. Right? You've carried it in your bodies. I just want you to know, just because you're in the Pacific Northwest doesn't mean that you were exempt from these kinds of things. It was illegal in places like Washington State and Oregon up until the 1960s for black and brown people to play poker together.
Wow.
It was illegal in Nevada up until the 70s to be found in a car with a black person. These are laws that were on the books. They may not have been enforced, but they were laws on the books. You could not enter a gambling establishment in California in the 1950s with a black person. A black person could not buy alcohol in the 50s and 60s. It was all on the books. So, let me just tell you that when I hear you say, but it's Seattle. No. Oh, but it's Montana. Idaho will exclude. But it doesn't matter. It really does not matter. Ask the black and brown people in your community what their experience of racism is once you've done the work for yourself. You'll discover where they lived, where they were, right? Ray Charles and Quincy Jones, as adolescents, were in Seattle, right? In black neighborhoods who were segregated. If you read Quincy Jones' autobiography, he talks about intimately his experience of racism in Seattle, right? So, if you're in America, guess what? You're part of the system, right? Don't get mad at me. So these things are the ways that we get to Jim Crow, right? So here's some quick sort of highlights of what Gates talks about. Again, great text. There's an era called the Redemption Era, which is from 1877 to 1915. The Redemption Era, notice Civil War's fought between what? Did I change it?
Yeah.
Sorry. 1860 to 1865, and then from 1866 to 1874 is what we call the Reconstruction Period, which is where we have the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment passed, we have voting rights, governors, black governors are elected in the South. Right, what happens in 1874 though?
The Union troops pull out of the field.
Why?
Because it was a compromise with the southern states after the Democrats almost won the presidency.
Right. So there's a political election in which there's a compromise. And the compromise that's on the table that the Southern Democrats put put forward is, okay, you can have the presidency, Republicans, if you pull out all the troops in the South. And so the Electoral College vote swings on this compromise, which some have argued is illegal. But so the president is elected, and immediately his first order of business is to withdraw all the troops from the federal troops from the South. And by 1876, you have statewide elections that begin the process of the Redemption Era. And what is the Redemption Era? It is the period in which white slaveholding gentry restore their power to govern. And they pass laws of enforcement. They repeal any of the suffrage laws, state, local laws, and then they create systems of oppression at the local level. The KKK is born during this time. Laws against loitering are born in this time. Many of the police departments in this country are founded during this period, 1877, 1915, as first and foremost, the old slave catching system is modified so that it now is about policing black bodies. So, the police system in this country traces its roots to this period, which is in the South in particular, about controlling and reinforcing the Redemption Era policies that arise. So, this becomes acute and limits all of this. And so it ends in 1915 with America's first major popular film, Birth of a Nation, right? Which is about what happens when you give black people power and you then have to take it back from them. And the starring heroes of that film are the KKK. This film is screened in the White House by the president at the time. Anybody know who it was?
Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson. Who was what before he became president of the United States? President of Princeton University, who enforced a barring of black people from Princeton University. Woodrow Wilson was on record believing that black people were fundamentally intellectually inferior and could not participate in intellectual systems and had no room. He also was the one that reinforced the ban against African Americans serving in the military, of which he had to begin to walk back by World War I. So then he allowed them to serve in segregated units there. Yes?
This went hand in hand with the so-called lost cause of the South.
That's exactly right. So while this is ongoing, the lost cause is also, which is about the grand narrative about what actually happened during the Civil War, right? We didn't really lose. We stood on our principles. So many of the statues that we now say were erected, they were all erected during this period, into the 1930s, right? So when people say, well, you know, this is about history. No, it's not. It's about propaganda. It's about the Redemption Era. It's about the lost cause, right? The birth of the stars and bars, the Confederate flag, of which there was no Confederate unified Confederate emblem during the Civil War. They're about every state militia had their own flag, right? So this idea of the stars and bars being the Confederate emblem is a part of the lost cause myth. And so when does it arise? During this period. To unify around not states' rights, but, states' rights, particularly to own slaves, right? This is a really big issue because one of the most problematic places to see stars and bars is not in the South, it's in Pennsylvania. When I drive from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia through this, I can see them waving everywhere. Pennsylvania was a Union state. Why are you flying the rebel flag? Because it's not about the Civil War. It's about fear and intimidation. And that's what hallmarked this period of time. Also at the same time, you have colleges and universities who are investing in racial science. Now I already told you race is a false social reality. But you had eugenics, And you had, I can't think of the other, I always forget the other word. I should put it in my notes. No, it's another, it was a fall, phenology. Phrenology, that's it. Come to me. Phrenology. So, which was the science behind proving, right? So we created the category, we've used religious justification. Now we use science to say things like black craniums, the craniums of black people are formed different. And the nerve endings in black people are deadened, so they don't really feel pain.
Oh,
right? Most of the medical procedures for that are done on pregnant women,
gynecology,
the whole science of gynecology is the field of gynecology is informed by one man who experimented during this period on and before that, in enslaved black women and poor black women, including performing live operations on them, C-sections, right?
Without medication,
right? So the book is entitled Medical Apartheid. And it details in history the medical procedures done to black people that are now standard in medicine. Because they have deadened nerve endings. And they, right? So this whole science, Harvard has a whole department dedicated to this. Harvard University has a whole department dedicated to phrenology and unpacking this science. Harvard's still around, right? Additionally, you have a narrative that gets created that says the burden of the white man in America now is to take care of the Negro. So then you start getting the rise of good societies who are helping white people, black people, from a patronizing perspective. And I will say, this is something that's still, this history here is still what's embedded in a lot of the work of white communities to black communities. And that's why there's a lot of resistance in many communities to the way in which white communities show up to help. Because it's, we need to fix this problem. But we're not a problem. You leave us alone, or whatever, you know. It's simply, you know, I don't like Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, because it actually carries on this trope. Right? If you read it and you're not informed, you can pull on a thread that says, you know, it's white people built it, so white people need to tear it down and do something new. No. White people built it. We all need to tear it down, and we all need to take responsibility to fix it. And there are plenty of black folks in that sphere who've done a better job of articulating that than Robin has. I hear she's got a new book coming out, and I'm nervous. So this becomes a real, you know, even on the progressive side during the Redemption Era, people who are, you know, for certain parts of integrating or anti-racist components, it still is this white man's burden. White man at the top, we've got to fix it, right? And that informs things like the social gospel movement of the late 19th century, early 20th century, and comes from this place. Lastly is sort of creating tropes of blackness, tropes what does it mean to be black, stereotypes, forming these kinds of things. So you get the rise of plantation narratives. Now, I'll tell you a story about Bugs Bunny in a minute. But you get the rise of plantation narratives, you get caricatures of blackness, right? This is where you get really racist images as a part of what's going on. And they take slave tales, stories that were told by slaves, and popularize them, right? So Br'er Rabbit, right? Rabbit's tales, right? Br'er Rabbit was stories, Uncle Remus's tales, right? These are all stories that are now being banned, which I think is problematic. We actually do need to talk about the history of these things. But Br'er Rabbit were stories that were told on plantations by slaves to keep for entertainment purposes. Well, Br'er Rabbit and the hare, there's a direct narrative lineage between those Br'er Rabbit and Uncle Remus stories and West African stories about gods, goddesses, and ways of engaging. And so there's great scholarship that has connected those threads. But why does that matter? Well, after Br'er Rabbit is published, it's a big thing, right? And what was the Disney movie?
Songs
of the South, right? So Songs of the South comes out as a way to take Chandler's stories, which were not his stories, they were stories he narrated from ex-enslaved persons. But the Br'er Rabbit, the whole point of the Br'er Rabbit tales was to actually talk about how Br'er Rabbit or the hare is smarter than the master, right? So actually, I'll delve into this a little further when we talk about resistance. So these stories become ways of resisting, and the hare or the rabbit is often the black person in the story, right? But here's the connection. Those stories then get popularized in Songs of the South, and then they get popularized by Warner Brothers in the form of Bugs Bunny. And Bugs Bunny becomes the personification of Br'er Rabbit, and unknowingly, the slave stories of the 1820s and 30s. So now you only go on YouTube to find Bugs Bunny because we've taken all of it off because we've said there are a lot of it's born in a racist period of time, and so Bugs Bunny carries a lot of racist imagery himself. But when you look at the story, who is the foil for Bugs Bunny? A white guy. You don't get it. You don't get it. Black people create Bugs Bunny, and then white people make money off of him. But the whole point is the black person is personified by the hare, who is always tricking the white guy. You still don't get it.
So why is that banned?
Because there are images that Bugs Bunny actually embodies that are racist, because the writers are white men who are writing for him. He always does, but sometimes he wins by taking on blackface. Sometimes he takes on these other, right? My argument is ban those episodes or show those episodes with a disclaimer, right? But here's the other piece. A lot of the people who pushed for that movement were black people who pushed and said, you know, we need to get rid of Bugs Bunny, we need to get rid of Bugs Bunny. And my argument was, black scholars need to weigh in this a little further because it's nuanced, right? Because in many ways, if you were in Rachel's presentation yesterday, she talked about the meaning of I can't think of the name now.
Kimosabe.
Thank you. The real meaning of Kimosabe, right? And so, in the same way, there's this underlying subversive satire that's happening. But we miss it because we miss the story behind stuff like that. Yeah?
Bugs Bunny is still only a rabbit. He's not more than a rabbit.
Yeah, but he can walk and talk.
He can walk and talk, but how far does a rabbit have?
Apparently a whole lot against a white guy with a shotgun. but you're exactly right. How much power can a rabbit actually have to outsmart a hunter with a 12-gauge shotgun? Well, actually a whole lot, because the undercurrent to the story is, and I'm not trying to be offensive, but the undercurrent here is white people are dumb. They can't outsmart a rabbit, right? And what the larger critique is not that it's a rabbit that's being outsmarted. It's that we who are African Americans know the truth, and we're smarter than our white masters. That's the moral of the story, but it's lost because we haven't done a good job of passing on the detail of that, right? So I'm running out of time. So I want to. This is some of the stuff from Phrenology, right? So this is a published journal showing the supposed differences between the skulls of the races. So you can't really see this, and I can't really see it either. But obviously, up in this corner is white European, and down here is an ape, and here in the middle is black, right? And so they're going across. Are these various features of the cranium. See, look, they're really closely related. Now, obviously, this is exaggerated, but the whole point is there are measurements that go along with this, right? You know who employs this as a real science to actually determine people's racial heritage? South Africans do it, but they do it first from Hitler, right? Quick story about from CAST. Isabel Wilkerson says after she reviewed the law, the stenographer's records from the meetings that formulated the final solution. Many of the Germans, architects of the final solution, studied in the American South. And when they were trying to figure out how to determine Jewish lineage, how much of blood, right? They found that they had to go with the formula they went with, which I think was your third grandmother or something like that. They settled on that because when they looked at one drop of black blood, which was the rule in America, one drop of black blood makes you black, they said that's too extreme. And she has this powerful line that says, American racism, Nazi Germany found American racism too unpalatable because it did not fit. If Aryans are really pure, how can one drop of black blood, just one drop, really? Right? So, you know, this heritage is still very much alive and well as a part of our identity. Here's another. Here's coming from the Redemption era. Right? This is between Democrats and Republicans. And the flyer says no third party can win. So there was a third way trying to split the difference between one party, the Republicans, were about racial progress. The other party, Southern Democrats, Dixiecrats, as we would call them, was about racial purity. And so they run on racial purity. And as you can see, what do they use? They use fear of black men as a way to scare votes. That sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it? Right? Only thing is we've switched the parties. Right? But this becomes normative, and you can't give them the vote, because if you do, your girls and your daughters won't be protected. Notice from when it's from.
1958.
Wow.
The American Eugenics Society. Unfit human traits such as feeble-mindedness, epilepsy, criminality, insanity, alcoholism, pauperism, and many others run in families and are inherited in exactly the same way as color in guinea pigs. If all marriages were eugenic, we could breed out most of this unfitness in three generations. You can improve your education and even change your environment, but what you really are was all settled when your parents were born. Selected parents will have better children. This is the great aim of eugenics. In other words, don't mix the races.
What is that from?
I'll find it. I think all of these are from the 20th century. Yeah. I think I don't have the record for this one. I may have it in my file. So this is in our lived memory, right? This was posted at the State Fair. They had a booth at the State Fair. Right? I'm gonna skip over that. Here's some more. Late 19th century, 1930s. We use black bodies to sell products. The advertisement here is, this soap is so good, it can turn black people white. That's it, right? Black people pure. Same thing with the veneer here. And so mass media reinforces these tropes and become normative, and they become objects of our reality up and through the 20th century, right? I think it was either Gap or Old Navy had to pull something just a few years ago that had people in blackface. Nobody thought that was... Right, we can tell when there's no black person of color or anybody in the marketing room. Right, you thought that was okay. Right, but these all have deep racial pieces that reinforce the realities in which we're living. So, when you add those pieces, right, the history of segregation, the history of passing down prejudices, fears of black bodies, when you add those pieces with segregation in the South and in other parts of the country, where you're not allowed to associate with each other, you're not allowed to interact with each other, you don't worship together, right? And then you couple that with, well, you know, black people just descended from apes, right? I have an aunt, she's deceased now, but she told the story of when she moved in to the dormitories in Bowling Green in the 1960s. And she moved in and she had a white roommate. And Bowling Green is in Ohio. And she's unpacking everything, and her white roommate kept staring at her. This went on for almost a week. And so finally she said, you know, why do you keep looking at me? Why? And she said, well, I was waiting for you to get undressed to see what your tail looks like. It's 1966, I think, 68. Lived memory, right? And so this is not, if you're not actively doing something to counteract this long legacy, then you are silently participating in a way that you didn't know, right? Some quick social legal stuff, and then I'm gonna stop so we can have room for dialogue and questions. Redlining. Y'all know what redlining is? Yeah? So redlining begins in Baltimore. Baltimore was the first state, first city in the early 20th century to pass laws that made sure that black people could not live in certain neighborhoods. From redlining, you also get covenants, right? Which are predicated on, you know, neighbors getting together saying, you know, you're not going to sell your house too, right? And you have to sign the covenant. Right, and both of those become covenants, and redlining become normative. The only difference between a covenant and redlining is redlining comes from the government, covenanting comes from neighbors allying together. Redlining is, of course, illegal. Covenanting still happens right now. Right, and in places like Seattle. Right, and so if you ever want to know why a neighborhood looks the way it looks, look in your records. There either was a history of covenanting or redlining going on as a part of this, right? Black people bring the property values down. That's what's behind redlining and covenanting. Criminal justice reform, or the lack thereof, right? The slave catcher's wagon becomes the paddy wagon of the 20th century, becomes the police car of the 21st century. We have not ever in this country had a conversation about policing, not like we've done around housing or civil rights or voting. Part of the movement of the current reality about defund police is really about having the conversation about the roots of American policing. The roots of American policing are from the slave catching system. You know who was responsible for cataloging and catching slaves? The sheriff's department. If you were a plantation owner and you lost your slaves, you went to the sheriff. Especially if you didn't have the resources to hire out your own posse. You went to the sheriff, and the sheriff was obligated to put together a posse and go find your slaves. After the Civil War, we reconstruct everything except the sheriff. Modern policing is predicated on the sheriff's basic authority. We have not had a conversation about the roots of American policing. Embedded in it are systems of racism that we have not ever had a conversation about. And so things like profiling, controlling people's movements, the bail system, right? All of those things stem from the period of slavery. And we've never had a national conversation about those things.
So,
So you don't think that that national conversation is happening, starting to happen now?
Now when I see flags, black and white flags with blue stripes in the middle and say Blue Lives Matter.
No, and I understand that. I guess I'm just curious, when you say we haven't had a conversation, where you would imagine that conversation that you would say we're having.
Gotcha. State levels. The place to have that conversation is not at the national level, you know, from national government. It's actually because sheriffs aren't national. Sheriffs are regional, local. Many of them are elected, right? And so that's the first place. But then your government, your elected government appoints police chiefs and other police officials. And so we're seeing pockets of this conversation, but we're not having, it's not happening everywhere is what I mean when we're not having a national conversation. Yeah. Yes?
This question may exceed time limits, what would a solution be?
What would be a way to reconceive policing in this country?
Yeah.
So a start is to recognize that we actually, as Americans, have way too many laws. It's not just the federal government, it's the state and local governments as well. We've regulated and over... When you go to other countries, there's certain laws that just don't exist that we have in this country. And I'm blanking on examples, but there are laws that have been passed that police people's bodies and rights and other kinds of things that if we are a free nation, we perhaps don't need. There are countries that are the size of states from a population perspective who have a fraction of the police force of our cities, right? Do we need, a city like Baltimore has a police force of 5,000. 5,000 officers for a population that is less than 300,000 in the borders of Baltimore City. Why do you have so many officers? And Baltimore City, I pick Baltimore because Baltimore is one of the oldest police departments in the country, modeled off of, it's older in some respects than the NYPD. And so why do you have to have so many police officers? Well, it's because it's so violent in Baltimore. Is it? Or are the ways in which the laws are structured the way we police people, right? So that's where the conversation starts. And then we say, do we need what we have? Well, what do we actually need? And then how do we enforce the laws that are on the books in ways that doesn't privilege race, class, geography, and other kinds of key issues? It doesn't mean that we pull police out of neighborhoods that actually need them, but it's actually, you do policing differently in those communities. My family, I have family in East Cleveland, Ohio, and you know, that was a rough neighborhood. But the police in East Cleveland, when I was growing up, would get out of their vehicles and walk the neighborhood, and they knew everybody's name. And that was probably the only time in my life where I actually felt safe when the police showed up. Yeah. Because I knew I could call on Mr. Ricky. They would sit by, my grandmother would make some tea, and if it was hot for them, and sit and chat for a minute. You know, he'd come by, Mr. Hardy, how you doing? You need anything? Everything's all right? And then there were a couple of disputes with a couple of neighbors. All we had to say is, now, if we call Mr. Ricky, there's going to be paperwork, and he's going to be mad. Can we just figure this out, right? It was very different. But now you've got quotas, you've got metrics, you've got policing standards that remove the police officer from committing time on the beat, which means they don't get to know their neighborhood, which means once you get that, then it escalates pretty quickly. Right. So then that's when you get situations where, you know, you have an autistic person being shot and killed because they're having an episode, and the police escalate because they don't know the family. Right. And these are the kinds of things that can actually be avoided if we figured out having an actual conversation. You're right. It's a longer dialogue. But those are some examples. We nullify through legal means. And so, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson, the Dred Scott decision, these are all legal ways in which black people don't have agency, right? Brown v. Board is 1955, Right? Again, these are things that we just started working on, of which we have been living with, and you have been living with for a long period of time. Certain communities are not allowed to protest. Right? They're not allowed to protest. You heard yesterday from Rachel that peaceful protests by indigenous peoples at Sandy Rock is met with private force, and the government does nothing. Right? Black communities. The Million Man March of 1993. Is that right? Three? Somebody help me. Three? Yeah. 1993, of which there were north of 800,000 black men on the Capitol grounds. The police departments, Capitol Police Department, National Park Service called out reinforcements all across the country to come and be present. There were no incidences of any kind. January 6th of 2021, about 10,000 white people show up and the police department says, we'll be fine, and they seek to overthrow the whole government. Right? Well, you have to go to 1993. January of 2020, when there are Black Lives Matter marches all throughout the country, police departments ramp up. Yep. You know, there were 18 jurisdictions present in D.C. that week. 18 from Maryland, D.C., Virginia, who were called in for about 4,000 to 6,000 protesters.
Question.
Yes.
So going back to the police stuff, how do you think they should handle like gangs? Like not just gangs for people who are uncovered, but like Mexican gang, people who are white gangs. Like, what do you think we see that?
Well, we seem to figure out a way to do it in the 1930s when Italian mafia got it. Right? Yeah. Al Capone didn't the question is, what do we do, what do police need to do with gangs? And not just gangs of color, but you know, organized crime, right? We need to recognize, I'll answer my question by talking about the opioid epidemic, right? So, America has had a long history with drugs, right? We didn't start dealing with heroin until white people took heroin. We never regularly addressed LSD and other psychotic drugs because partly the government made them. Crack came to the urban neighborhoods. Crack cocaine came to the neighborhoods. But cocaine was present in the boardrooms in the 1970s and 80s. Cocaine was actually present in the 1800s as a headache powder, which I don't know how that works. But anyway. So the way that we dealt with drugs was, as long as it didn't happen to the upper end of the caste, it was fine, right? And so once it started happening to white folks, and really not just white folks, but once it started happening to upper middle class and upper middle class white folks, because poor white people were experiencing the opioid epidemic for a long time as well, we then put our resources there to figure out what to do. In the same way, we don't really see ourselves having a gang problem that needs to be addressed until white people start being killed by it, right? And so part of what's happening here is we're not even privileging the voices of the persons of color. So that means elevating the needs of our black and brown communities as a part of the policing structure. What that also means is you need to be quizzing your police chiefs and your sheriffs about how they are uniformly addressing gang problems. Because the meth epidemic is also run by organized crime, right? Connected to Mexican cartels, but there are white communities who are participating in that work. Why is it that we police the Mexican border and we don't really police the Canadian border the same way?
Yeah,
next to you. Right, and this whole myth that, what about black on black crime? What about black on black crime? Well, when a black person kills another black person, they go to jail. But when a white person, white police officer kills a black person, they don't. Well, it's something called qualified immunity, which is not in the Constitution, it's not legal, it's a legal precedent that the Supreme Court created so that police officers can do their job. Nobody's arguing that policing is an easy job. But we are arguing that if there's a disproportionate record of white folks killing, white police officers specifically, killing black folks, can we do something about that? Right? So this whole black on black crime, white on black crime, which is a real myth, because I counter with, what about white on white crime? You know, there's a whole lot of that going on, right? So let's just not talk about black on black crime like black people are disproportionately contributing to crime in all sorts of ways, over here and then over here.
And I just wanted to add, that's a great question about gangs and knowing the community. Like, gangs don't form because people are bad. They form because people don't have access. Like, I had a good friend explain to me that for many black and African American people in her neighborhood, it's the only option because they can't get jobs because people won't hire them because they're black. And it becomes a question of, do I feed my family? Well, if I sell drugs, I make a lot of money very fast. It's the only option I have. So if we look at a neighborhood in a community holistically, what are the things that what are the things that are causing the violence? Violence is a symptom of poverty. So these are things, it's never just one thing. It's a whole thing that needs to be looked at.
Yeah. It is 12:03. I want to get to your question, but if you need to head out, we can do that. Tomorrow we will start turning towards resistance and looking at the ways in which these systems have been countered by the same Christian identity in strong ways. Thank you for your time, but if you want to ask questions, please continue to do so. Let's go up here. Effective. Yeah, so I strongly think that we have to struggle with what protest means. So protest can mean, perhaps there's no such thing as a peaceful protest. Protests are disruptive by their very, it's not a protest unless it's disruptive. It's not effective. But you really do have to ask the question, why would otherwise a peaceful, law-abiding citizen feel so angry? What makes them feel so angry that they would pick up a rock and throw it? Not at a person, but at a window, right? Martin Luther King said it, I think, in the best way, which is the protest, violent protest, riots are the voice of the unheard. And what we have to struggle with is not, oh, look at those bad people, but why, what are they arguing about that they feel the need to do these things? And we got a whole system and industry designed to protect the property. So let them burn it. As long as nobody's deemed at risk, if they're going to blow up a building, this is me talking. If you got insurance, I'm talking about a government building, not a house, but a government building. If you got insurance, then... I don't want to say it because I am a president of an institution. I don't not say it on record. Yeah. Yes. Go ahead.
I would love to hear your thoughts on cancel culture.
Yes, yes. So cancel culture, right? Another social imaginary construct, which comes from, started by progressives talking about canceling, right? Which was, I think, we make up too many words for stuff that is good and wholesome. There's a difference, well, no. Canceling someone is really about engaging consequences for their behavior, right? I don't like the language. This is me talking. I don't like canceling somebody because it suggests that somehow you delete them from your existence. But I'm a firm believer in holding someone accountable, right? And part of what cancel culture is a moniker, a pejorative moniker on the consequences that people ought to feel, right? So many on the conservative side are going to say, you know, this is just cancel culture. And my response to that is, no, you do have consequences for the choices you make. And, you know, what I have to get my progressive folks to understand is to really not use canceling as a way. Just say, we're going to hold you accountable.
Yeah.
Right? It's a Twitter word. Right? And so it's easy to say canceling, but my concern about that is you actually are replicating a hegemonic structure.
Yeah.
Right? Which you actually are deleting someone's existence all over again.
What is that word I saw earlier and I was going to ask you?
Hegemony. It's a philosophical construct that is about a system of oppression, an all-encompassing system of oppression, right? And so Christendom has within it a patriarchal hegemony, a whole structure in which men are asserted as oppressive. So canceling, I don't like as a word because it embodies sort of deleting people. And so we get to not speak to you again. We get to not, we're excluded from the social structure. And I don't, that's not my theology. That's not my ideology. You do, however, need to be held accountable for your behavior. And that looks like saying, you know, if you're going to be a part of this and you say something like that, we are not going to do business with you. We're not going to such and such. We hope your business, if that's the business model you have, we're going to actually make sure you're out of business. Right? But you're welcome to come back and learn. And grow. I mean, I take the Matthew 18 position, which is always assuming grace, but saying to you, holding you accountable, you know, Asa, you said these things, and this is problematic, and so do you repent? Well, no. Okay, come with me. Asa, you said these things, right? Cancel culture suggests, nope, you said these things, you're done. Right?
It's the cultural equivalent of shunning,
what
you
said. It's the lack of
redemption. Is that right there? It is, shunning still provides the opportunity for you to come back, right?
Yes,
there's
yes,
no redemption
yes,
in canceling, yes. Right? So if someone were to come back and say, I've studied, I've learned, I've grown from my mistakes, they've got to rehabilitate their entire life, and their entire life is associated by that one incident. And that really does not sit well with me theologically. And I get the impetus behind it, which is an impatience with all of the stuff that we've had to deal with for 500 years, 600 years. We don't need time. But the problem is, if there's no redemption for you, then there's no redemption for me. So if you're canceled at some point, then at some point I might be canceled for a mistake that I made. And that becomes really problematic and further silos us. But this idea is even more crap than the cancel idea. Right? Because then it says, oh, everybody's trying to cancel everybody. No, we actually should, in good human, healthy human society, hold one another accountable for when we make mistakes. And so that's yeah.
More specifically, what are your thoughts on the statues and monuments?
Yeah.
And they hurt some people. They're also dead people who can't redeem themselves.
Yeah, so... So I'll answer it this way. Statues have never taught anybody anything. Teachers teach people things. Museums and archives teach things. Statues are all about propaganda. Statues are fundamental ways that we reinforce a mythos, right? I don't learn about the fullness of Abraham Lincoln by visiting the Lincoln Memorial. I get snippets of his speeches, and I get impressed by a very large guy sitting on a throne, right? What we think happens with statues is that, oh, and I've heard this said, they see the statue and they say, oh, wow, I'll go back and research them. Doesn't happen, right? But the spirit in which statues are erected are really about codifying a certain image of someone for a mythic narrative. And I'm going to use someone that you all may find these surprising for me to hear. I really have a problem with the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C. I do not like it. I do not think we should be erecting a monument to someone who told us not, he said out of his mouth literally, do not build me a monument. He said that. And what do we do? Build monument. And you know who the group was who led it? Black groups led that. Oh! Why? Because as soon as you cut the ribbon on it, you've now created a narrative that has to be reinforced, which creates a myth. First and foremost, Martin Luther King was voted the most hated man in this country when he was alive. Right? We don't know that because we've got a narrative now. He was the most hated man in this country. Black, white, period. He was seen as a disruptive, chaotic individual who was overturning the status quo. You don't get assassinated for being liked, after all. So we then build a statue that does not tell the full picture of what happened, and therefore we create a mythic narrative that we then have to buy into. Right? And the problem with those things is that, with statues, is that they come with narratives, and we don't teach our children in school or otherwise to question the narrative. If you have statues, you should also be teaching people to question what they read and see about the statue, right? So that's just on something like Martin Luther King. You got a statue of Robert E. Lee there. Okay, rebel leader, that's all I got. Right? He was a patriot. He was someone who was a revered commander, West Point grad, all of that. But then he renounced his oath and went to his state. At that moment, you ceased to be a part of the mythic narrative of the Union. You become the rebel leader. And we should be asking ourselves, why is it that we're the only country in the League of Nations, the Community of Nations, that has wide room for the losers of a civil war? Race. Right? And so, you know, my wife, who is an immigrant from an African country who survived a civil war, is always perplexed. Her and her family are always perplexed at this. I mean, y'all, their flags and there are, right? In her civil war, there were three factions. Well, actually, five factions. And two presidential assassinations and a whole bunch of other stuff. People know the names of those individuals. You know why? Because some of their children are still alive. One of them is a war criminal imprisoned at The Hague, right? So you know their names because we don't ever want to go back there again. There are no statues of Charles Taylor in Liberia. Prince Johnson, who was one of the other sub-factions, is still alive, but he's been shunned, ostracized, and has been forced to repent of his ways. Ironically, though, he did run in the past election, which is a whole other
thing. Aren't there some mythic narratives that you want to preserve, though? I mean, I'm a little perplexed by your resistance to the Martin Luther King, frankly, because, I mean, it seems like there's not, you know, it's different than preserving a mythic, building a mythic narrative around a bunch of traitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is different.
This is a legitimate resistance. I mean, complicated person, sure. But why not encourage people to revere Martin Luther King? And, you know, maybe some people will learn more about him. At least we'll.
Yeah, so again, the first reason is he told us not to. Yeah, so I mean, it's the best example of we don't listen. but I get your point about other, you know, folks who, you know, we should look up to, right? The problem is we do not teach equally suspicion of the narrative that we're given. We don't do that. We don't examine, you know, and so then we're shocked when we discover that Martin Luther King smoked, for example. Was a chain smoker.
Or that Abraham Lincoln, you know, had racist, you know.
Right. Ideas. Or the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was an adulterer.
Yeah.
Right. We lose that because the narrative becomes ingrained in us, and so I resist. I'm coming to you. I resist I resist strongly because I always have a suspicious position of a statue when I see it and say, I wonder what's going on here.
The Bible too, as far as that.
And I do. You know, my students will say, all the time, you're suspicious of everything. Yeah. Yes, I am. You know, I'm suspicious of sometimes my own actions, right? But I'm, you know, we should question the Judeo-Christian narrative as it is given to us. That's actually a good rabbinic way. The rabbis in Midrash do that very work. We Christians don't have a tradition of Midrash. So, but we should be questioning. And so I question, where's this coming from, and who wrote it, and why is it here? Who put the statue up, right? Daughters of the American Revolution, or the Daughters of the Confederacy, or, right? I'm deeply suspicious of Thomas Jefferson Memorial, just as much as I am. Now, I grew up in Washington, D.C. So I grew up in an African-American community in Washington, D.C., who naturally is deeply suspicious in the shadow of liberty. You had some of the most rabid segregation in the shadow of liberty. So I come from a culture that was a tradition in a neighborhood and a community that was already suspicious because we weren't even allowed in some of the museums or in some of the monuments until the 60s and the 70s. So forgive me if I'm not really impressed. Now, there are, I'll tell you, the most impressive monument I've ever been a part of and ever seen was in South Africa in Pretoria. And at that point, this was before the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It was a park. It's now over a decade old. I'm actually even older than that. But it was just being completed. It was just open in Pretoria, in which it was a monument and a statuary dedicated to the victims of oppression around the world. And so there were a series of statues and monuments over, I think, 40 or so, in which you could see victims of like the Holocaust, victims of apartheid. And there, right there in the midst, was the untold numbers from the transatlantic slave trade. And I sat in front of that column and wept because I realized I had to travel 8,000 miles to get an acknowledgement of the suffering of mine, right? That to me gives context in the moment, gives a sense of what we've been through, and they invested in creating not just a mythic narrative, but the story of humanity's inhumanity to each other, right? Unless you can do that on a consistent basis with the personalities that are there, which we just don't do. We just don't do that work. So that's why I'm always suspicious. It could be Mother Teresa. It could be Dr. Martin Luther King. I'm just suspicious of it. And people like that, their greatest monument, because what King said, the other part of that quote was, the greatest monument you can build is equality for my people. So we build a stone statue, but we're still fighting the same fights we fought 60 years ago. Yeah.
That reminds me of a Socrates quote that was, he hates books because books can't argue back. And Martin, the thing that I was so shocked to hear was that Martin Luther King was a socialist. And you never hear that, and you'll never hear that because you know you got enshrined Martin Luther King Day, you got enshrined the statues. You're never going to hear that Martin Luther King completely opposed the status quo to the point of potentially somewhat aligning himself with foreign powers.
Yeah, the biggest indictment and the reason why he was hated was he was a communist, not just a socialist. He was a communist. Now, in 21st century. Americans don't know the difference between communism and socialism, so, you know, we throw people and say socialist, and we really mean communist, and we don't know what either mean. But yeah, you know, but let's be clear, Medicaid and Medicare is democratic socialism, so we're already partly, you know, socialists in that way. Okay, let's eat, y'all.